enough working equipment, and longshore workers were accused of orchestrating problems by red-tagging machinery in good condition, sidelining it for repairs.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. American Federation of Government Employees Union President David Cox Sr. says the union is deeply disturbed by the findings in a report just released on the November 1st, 2013 shooting death of Transportation Security Officer Gerardo Hernandez at LAX. Cox says the lack of incident coordination documented in the report is absolutely unacceptable. The officer was not given medical attention until 33 minutes after being shot. Cox said the report demonstrates that security processes and systems at LAX are fundamentally broken. Cox called on TSA and the LAX authorities to take swift action to correct the problems. A coalition of labor and safety activists in Massachusetts is pushing for a health and safety bill that would extend standardized health and safety protections to 150,000 state employees. Marcy Goldstein-Gelb is executive director of MassCosh, the Massachusetts Coalition for Occupational Safety and Health.
State employees are working very high on our bridges, making sure that they're functioning. They're with a hair's breadth of moving traffic, fixing our roads. They're our first responders who are facing violent criminals, putting out fires. They spend all day lifting patients out of bed. It cumulatively adds up to about 10,000 pounds each day. So they really have very significant dangers and hazards that they face, just as much or more than those in the private sector.
The Health and Safety Bill has passed the state legislature's Joint Committee on Labor and Workforce Development. Goldstein-Gelb says state workers have allies in the legislature on this health and safety legislation, and she's optimistic it will become law, extending the private sector OSHA-style health and safety regulations to Massachusetts state workers.
We do have a wonderful group of champions in the legislature and out in the community, and we're very hopeful that this session is going to be it. We're going to win it this time. This is an exciting period of time in the state for ensuring that our state employees get the safety and protections that they deserve with the hard work and dangerous work that they do, and we're excited about being a part of this transformational time.
On Monday, MassCosh and the Deval Patrick administration will be announcing the achievements of an executive order that put infrastructure in place to examine health and safety compliance of various state departments. That will make it easier to implement the new health and safety bill when it does become law.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Many of Oregon's poorest students are missing out on federal aid each year, according to Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission. About 1 in 5 eligible students are missing out on the need-based Pell Grants. The 14-member Higher Education Coordinating Commission, which oversees higher education for the state, is currently putting together a plan to help more students apply for financial aid. This program could earn Oregon students as much as $80 million in financial aid. The commission plans to aim public service messages at schools with large populations of low-income students and to assist students in filling out federal student aid forms to apply for the grants. According to the Oregonian, many Portland schools, such as Roosevelt High, David Douglas High, and Ontario High, would benefit from the program. At Roosevelt, only 28 students filled out the federal application in 2013. But one-third of the school's 800 students could likely qualify for those grants. The group noted that Oregon's financial aid program is underfunded and has a tight one-month deadline. Because of this, many deserving students are not to benefit from it. The federal program, on the other hand, has an 18-month deadline and provides more than $3,000 per student per term. This is twice as much money per student as the state program provides. The federal Pell Grant program also funds every student who qualifies for the program, unlike the first-come, first-served state program. But by putting more effort into getting students to apply for the federal program, the commission hopes to increase college graduation rates here in Oregon.
A day-long session was held in Central Point yesterday to sort out the future of rural policing in Oregon. The session was called after large cutbacks in local police. The cutbacks were necessary because the citizens of a number of southern Oregon counties have refused tax increases to fund more police. These cuts have resulted in some complaints over how little police presence and protection is currently available in many rural areas in southern Oregon. But there has been no significant increase in crime in the areas where cuts to police have been put in place.
A new report has found that temperature around the world is rising at a greater rate than at any time in the last 65 million years. The report was published by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which is the world's largest scientific society. The association rarely gets involved in public policy issues, but they said this issue is too important for them not to take a stand. The report is aimed at climate change skeptics to show people the extent to which scientists are concerned about rapid and abrupt climate change. Recent polls show that more than 30% of Americans believe that there is a widespread disagreement among scientists about whether climate change is happening at all. But actually, there's a virtual consensus worldwide among climate scientists that humans are causing climate change and that the situation is dire. Although no one knows how severe the effects of global warming will be, most scientists agree that global temperatures may rise by up to 8 degrees in the next 100 years. That's nearly as much as they've seen risen since the last ice age. That is, the temperatures are set to rise over the next 100 years by the same amount that they've risen over the last 12,000 years. And the report also addresses claims raised by skeptics that other things like the Earth's orbit, solar output, and volcanic eruptions are to blame for climate change. The scientists say that while these things have a slight impact, it is human action that is to blame for the current massive shift in temperature taking place around the world. The report stressed the need for immediate action to reduce the impact of climate change. The report comes in advance of a meeting in Japan next week by the IPCC, the United Nations Climate Science Panel.
As the first day of spring approaches tomorrow, a lot of people are thinking about spring cleaning. It isn't just about organization, but also safety. For those who are caregivers, the plan should include disposing of old medications and removing clutter to improve mobility. For more, we go to KBOO's Susan Cecil in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
With spring set to officially arrive tomorrow, Oregonians may be in the mood to do some spring cleaning. One expert says that with a few simple tips, the process doesn't need to be so hard. Professional organizer Amelia Hatcher says, for most people, it isn't realistic to maintain a home in perfect order each day. Instead, people should focus on clearing out the clutter.
Clutter is anything that causes frustration, anxiety, or chaos in your life. It completely drains you of your energy. It could be the pile of paper on your desk. It could be the pile of laundry, your dumping ground, like your kitchen table, and it just completely causes stress.
The National Association of Professional Organizers says that minimizing clutter saves time and money. Amelia, the clutter queen, also recommends only tackling one area at a time, so you don't get discouraged. Hatcher says she was drawn into the field about 5 years ago when she began helping family and friends to get better organized. For caregivers, she points out that getting rid of clutter minimizes chaos and also helps with safety by improving mobility.
I've had several situations where people have fallen, broken a hip, and it's actually not safe in the home. So it's my goal to go in and change things around to where the home's more accessible to things like walkers, possibly a wheelchair.
Hatcher says old medications should be properly disposed of, and old documents with personal information should be shredded to protect against identity theft. For KBOO News, I'm Susan Cecil.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for an interview with Professor Francis Boyle after this newscast to explore the latest developments in Ukraine and Crimea and the U.S. role in the current situations. That'll be followed by Occupy Radio at 6 o'clock. Tonight's show features Professor William Black, a former financial regulator, associate professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He'll talk about the ongoing financial shenanigans of Wall Street banks and explore why no one has been sent to jail for the crimes that brought us into the Great Recession. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective, featuring Lavelle Mixon and Stokely Carmichael. The weather will be partly cloudy and cool tonight, with a low of 34, and tomorrow will be a bit warmer with a high of 54 and only a 10% chance of rain. The folks at radcast.org have temporarily suspended the daily radiation count until they're able to get more volunteers to support their effort. You can find more information on how you can help radcast.org at radcast.org.
It is now 5:16, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The counselor advised an informal setting, adding that it is, quote, an effective way to build a better relationship. That sounds like advice that a love counselor might offer to couples, but not so. This relationship is about money. The counselor is a lobbyist for the healthcare industry, and he was explaining the art of wooing Congress critters by paying several thousand bucks to spend a weekend with them at some posh resort in Vail, Key West, or other luxury getaway. By holding what are called destination fundraisers outside of Washington, lawmakers and lobbyists can spend quality time together as they ski, snorkel, and schmooze. It's a way to get some large chunks of a lawmaker's time, oozed the lobbyist, who had recently enjoyed 3 days at the Four Seasons Resort in Vail with five Republican House members, two of whom are on the committee that writes our health laws. But wait, wasn't there a big stink over golf junkets a few years ago, forcing Congress to prohibit lobbyists from paying for these back-alley affairs? Yes, but Washington believes that where there's a will, there's a workaround. Here's how this one works. The lawmakers' political committees pay for their travel, food, booze, and lodging, so these expenses, technically, are not gifts from lobbyists. In turn, the favor seekers come at their own expense, plus making legal donations to the members' reelection campaigns. The donations end up being 3 or 4 times the cost of the event, so the lawmakers pocket a nice wad of cash, while the lobbyists enjoy a weekend of making legislative whoopee. Since the donations and the event are considered, quote, separate transactions, it's all legal. See? This is Jim Hightower saying, neither do I. In fact, what I see is just another corrupt way for corporations to buy Congress. Who do they think they're fooling?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Federal Election Commission has dismissed a complaint that Chevron violated federal laws with a $2.5 million campaign contribution in the 2012 election. The complaint was filed by a coalition of environmental groups concerned about Chevron's excessive influence on U.S. elections. The FEC used the legal distinction between Chevron USA Incorporated and Chevron Corporation to dismiss the complaint. After the dismissal of the complaint, Public Citizen called on the FEC to revisit its policy of drawing artificial distinctions between affiliates within the same wholly owned corporate entity. Craig Holman of Public Citizen says that this type of massive campaign contribution has its roots in the 2010 Supreme Court decision known as Citizens United.
Ever since the Citizens United decision on January 21, 2010, corporations have felt free to start spending wildly in American elections. And they have done so. We've seen a fourfold increase in outside spending, even though we don't know where much of the money is coming from because corporations tend not to be subject to disclosure of their political spending. However, when it comes to government contractors fall under an entirely different federal law. They are prohibited, the federal government contractors are prohibited from making campaign contributions to party committees, to political action committees, and to candidates. So it's a whole different category of business spending in politics. As a government contractor, because of the likelihood that those types of campaign contributions are being made in order to buy favor with public officials in order to win government contracts. There's a whole new federal law that just prohibits them from making campaign contributions. Now, Chevron Corporation just went ahead and did it anyway. And so they made a $2.5 million contribution to the Congressional Leadership Fund, which is a super PAC working on behalf of Speaker Boehner and the Republican National Congressional Committee. And that, I alleged, violated the pay-to-play law, the federal pay-to-play law that prohibits campaign contributions from government contractors. Because when I went through the government contractor database that's online, you see Chevron Corporation, along with Chevron USA, showing up as contractors, federal contractors, during that period that campaign contribution was made. So I filed a complaint with the Federal Election Commission about a year ago and asked them to take a close look. Did Chevron Corporation violate the pay-to-play law? And much to my disappointment, the Federal Election Commission determined just a little while ago that Chevron Corporation did not violate the pay-to-play law because they distinguished between Chevron USA versus Chevron Corporation. And they said at the time, the specific date of that campaign contribution, which was October 7th, 2012, Chevron USA was a government contractor, but Chevron Corporation at that point didn't have any specific contracts. Therefore, they determine, even though they're the same members of the corporate family, that Chevron Corporation could get away with making this campaign contribution. And just to, you know, emphasize this a little more, you know, the whole purpose of a pay-to-play law is to ensure that a company doesn't make a campaign contribution to a public official and the public official returns the favor with a contract. Well, you know, the public official getting a contribution from Chevron Corporation has no idea that there's any legal distinction between Chevron Corporation versus Chevron USA. To them, and to all of us, really, it's the same company. And so it just defeats the whole heart and soul of pay-to-play laws.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. And I mean, just looking at it, I wouldn't be able to see a distinction between them. So how would anyone else be able to see that? And just to, not to play devil's advocate or anything, but so since they were a government contractor of the United States back in, what, 2012, you said, wouldn't that just be like, hey, you know, you contracted with us, thanks for that, so we're going to give you $2.5 million. Like, what is so bad about them turning around and giving money to this super PAC?
Well, the very purpose of a pay-to-play law is to try to prevent the corruption that we've seen all over the place at the state and local level and the federal level. And that's when a wealthy business wants to buy a very lucrative government contract. And once they can hand over something like $2.5 million to the public officials who are responsible for awarding those contracts, that just rigs the whole government contracting process. You know, suddenly contracts are likely to be awarded based upon campaign contributions rather than merit. That's the harm. The purpose of a pay-to-play law, you know, is primarily to protect the government contracting process, to make sure that people have confidence that our tax dollars are going to pay for contracts that are going to be handled well by those who bid for them, not to hand out political favors to campaign contributors.
That was Chris Holman of Public Citizen speaking about the dismissal of a complaint that Chevron violated federal laws with a $2.5 million campaign contribution in the 2012 election. His group is planning to appeal the dismissal with the Federal Elections Commission.
A U.S. lawyer yesterday appealed a federal judge's ruling that he used fraud to secure a ruling against Chevron in Ecuador. The company lost a case brought by indigenous groups whose land and homes were destroyed by Chevron's oil drilling. The company was ordered to pay a $9.5 billion fine, but Chevron has challenged the legality of that ruling and refused to pay the indigenous groups for their loss. Instead, the company filed a lawsuit against the lawyer representing the Ecuadorian natives. Residents of Ecuador say that oil giant Chevron dumped deadly toxic waste connected with oil extraction in a number of indigenous homelands. Even since the court ruling, Chevron continues to operate in Ecuador and recently discharged 18 tons of oil waste. Local residents have linked the oil waste to the destruction of valuable rainforests as well as deaths, miscarriages, and birth defects among native communities.
And now the latest stories from our partners at National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Tristan Ottone, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. A group in Mankato, Minnesota, has created a petition asking the White House to posthumously pardon the Dakota 38. As Carrie Young reports, the online petition has collected about 350 signatures so far.
The day after Christmas in 1862, 38 Dakota men were hung in Mankato, Minnesota, after being found guilty of capital crimes committed against white settlers during the Dakota War. It was the largest mass execution in U.S. history. The Dakota 38 were among about 400 others who were tried in a military court after the conflict. The trials were conducted in English, often without defense lawyers, and many lasted less than 5 minutes. Supporters of the pardon say the Dakota people, quote, deserve to know that their ancestors were not criminals, unquote, adding that they were just men fighting to protect their families and way of life. The petition is currently on the whitehouse.gov website. In order to get a response from the Obama administration, it must collect over 100,000 signatures by March 29th. For National Native News, I'm Carrie Young.
The Mashantucket Pequot Tribe of Connecticut have banished two former leaders convicted of embezzling money from the tribe. Brothers Michael Thomas and Stephen Thomas have been told by the Elders Council to stay away, quote, from the Mashantucket Western Pequot Reservation and all tribal lands. Former tribal chairman Michael Thomas is serving 18 months in prison for embezzling over $100,000 from the tribe. Stephen Thomas, the former tribal treasurer, is serving probation and owes the tribe a little over $177,000 after pleading guilty to theft. Native women are creating, developing, and expanding in the business world. And as National Native News anchor Antonia Gonzalez reports, they're representing their businesses at the National Reservation Economic Summit in Las Vegas.
More than a decade ago, a company was created to design hotel and casino carpet for tribes and expanded to other areas, including commercial flooring and porcelain. It became Total Solutions. The company is an American Indian woman-owned business. President and CEO Robin Coffey says being a woman in the construction world can be challenging.
Business is not always so pretty on the other side sometimes.
She says partnerships can be an obstacle. To overcome that, she surrounded herself with people and partners who share her vision. The company is now branching into another area focusing on medical equipment. Coffey received the Native Woman Business Owner of the Year Award at the National Center for American Indian Enterprise Development Conference.
It's important that women in business are recognized because sometimes I think it gets underserved sometimes, and to point out their strengths and growing businesses.
Coffey says it's also important for businesses to mentor. Among those taking advantage of learning from others is Hallie Hanlon Ward. A few years ago, Joint Mission Essential Training Solutions was established to provide services to military members. Hanlon Ward is on track to taking over as CEO in a few weeks.
You know, if I was in uniform, I feel like I could, you know, really walk up and defend myself because I'm in uniform and it's obvious that I'm there for a purpose, whereas in the business world, I'm wearing heels and I miss my combat boots, so it's quite different. It's definitely a really big learning curve, and I'm really thankful for a lot of the mentors that I've met here.
Some things she's learned are to gain an understanding of the business world and seek help from those with more experience. Sessions at the conference run through Thursday. In Las Vegas, I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
During this week in 1972, the nonprofit Organization for Alaska Natives in the Arctic Slope Region was established. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Ottone.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska.
The National Security Agency's senior attorney confirmed today that user information from tech companies was obtained with the full knowledge and assistance of those firms. NSA General Counsel Rajesh Day appeared before a hearing of the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, responding to questions about the agency's collection of information under the FISA Amendment Act. When Edward Snowden leaked documents concerning the NSA's PRISM program last year, all companies participating in the program, Yahoo, Apple, Microsoft, Facebook, Paltalk, and AOL, denied providing the NSA with bulk access to their customers' data. According to documents leaked by Snowden, the NSA possesses unmediated access to the company data regardless of authorization.
Human rights lawyers called on a federal appeals court on Tuesday to reopen a case brought by four former Iraqi detainees who were tortured at the notorious Abu Ghraib prison. The appeal was filed roughly 11 years since the U.S. invasion of Iraq against the private military contractor who ordered the men to be tortured. The private contractor, CACI Premier Technology, which ordinarily goes by its acronym, which sounds like khaki, the company is a U.S. corporation that helped run the Abu Ghraib prison, where multiple instances of horrific torture were documented. Lawyers for the Center for Constitutional Rights filed Tuesday's appeal after a lower court's ruling allowed the private contractor to go free. According to the CCR, the lower court's ruling creates lawless spaces where corporations can commit torture and war crimes and then find safe havens inside the United States. The torture in question was documented in photos showing naked, blindfolded detainees stacked in piles with smiling soldiers giving thumbs up in front of them. Lawyers for CCR said the contractors walked free despite having ordered soldiers, who were later court-martialed, to commit what they called sadistic, blatant, and wanton criminal abuses. Last June, a district court judge dismissed the case by narrowly interpreting a former Supreme Court decision that limited U.S. courts' ability to rule on human rights violations committed outside the United States. But according to the appeal, as a U.S. company working in a U.S.-run prison in a country that was militarily occupied by the U.S., they should be subject to U.S. law.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, March 18, 2014. Israeli troops kidnap civilians from West Bank communities and Navy warships attack fishing boats in Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli troops abducted on Tuesday 8 Palestinians, including 3 teenagers, during invasions targeting Bethlehem and Hebron districts in southern West Bank. Local sources reported that soldiers stormed homes in Bethlehem City and the nearby Al-Azza refugee camp, as well as Beit Fajar village south of Bethlehem. Troops kidnapped 5 civilians, including 3 teenagers. 3 more men were kidnapped when Israeli troops raided a number of homes in Hebron Old City and nearby towns and villages on Tuesday morning, local sources reported. In Gaza, Palestinian sources reported that Israel will reopen the Kerem Shalom crossing with the Gaza Strip on Wednesday after keeping it closed for 6 consecutive days. The sources said that Israeli officials had informed the Palestinian side that the Kerem Shalom crossing would resume operations on Wednesday. The crossing was opened on Sunday and Monday, but only for fuel deliveries. Israel shut down the crossing last Wednesday in the wake of a flare-up of violence which began when Israeli airstrikes killed 3 Palestinian militants in southern Gaza the day before. Staying in Gaza, Israeli warships fired on Palestinian fishermen off the coast of the southern Gaza Strip, fishermen said. Fishermen told local news that the Israeli forces fired at them off the coast of Khan Yunis. No injuries were reported, but the fishermen said that they were forced to sail back to shore. An Israeli military spokeswoman said that the boat had deviated from its designated fishing zone. In the Oslo Accords, Israel agreed to a 20 nautical mile fishing zone of Gaza's coast, but it imposed a 3-mile limit for several years, opening fire at fishermen who stray further. There are some 4,000 fishermen in Gaza, according to a 2011 report by the International Committee of the Red Cross. 90% are poor, a 40% increase from 2008, resulting from Israeli limits on the fishing industry. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, March 18th, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, just as the last Canadian soldiers returned home from Afghanistan today, news emerged that two soldiers took their own lives. One 44-year-old corporal who served in Afghanistan was found dead in his home in Quebec, and another soldier in Ontario was found dead over the weekend. Today's announcement comes on the heels of a U.S. report that the number of young veterans committing suicide jumped dramatically from 2009 to 2011. There was a 44% increase in suicides among male veterans under 40. This means an average of two soldiers every day take their own lives in this country. Veteran Affairs officials say they've increased hotlines and help for veterans, but the assistance is not adequate to meet the need.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Desiree Garcia, Ken Jones, Merrick Bonneau, Susan Cecil, and David Lassam. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at @kboonews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty talks with a representative of the ACLU about their new report, The War on Marijuana, and Fighting Racial Breakdowns in Arrest for Marijuana Possession. At 9 o'clock, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, we hear a special live broadcast of the Persian Hour as Iranians celebrate Nowruz, the Persian New Year, in Portland at the exact time of the spring equinox. At 10:30, we'll hear a shortened edition of Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, host Jay Thiemeyer interviews local author Willie Vlotten about his new novel, The Free, which follows the story of a brain-damaged Iraqi war veteran who lives in a group home. And at 11:30 on the radio zine, Ren Green speaks with Joan Foley of Headland Community Radio in Port Headland, Western Australia, about her all-volunteer station, her childhood radio experiences, and why community radio is especially important in Australia. Thank you, KBOO members, for your great support for this community station. You can become a member right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for an interview with Professor Francis Boyle about the situation in Crimea and Ukraine, conducted by KBOO's Jekka Soderberg. And have a great evening.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm speaking now with Professor Francis Boyle. He's a professor at the University of Illinois College of Law and the author of Foundations of World Order, among other books. And I wonder if you could just start by addressing the question whether the annexation of Crimea by Russia is an illegal action.
Well, thank you for having me on, and my best to your listening audience. I guess that really depends on the validity of what the people in Crimea did under international law. And there the test is set forth by the UN General Assembly in a resolution known as the Declaration on Principles of International Law Concerning Friendly Relations Cooperation Among States, which was approved by the International Court of Justice in the Nicaragua case. And there it says quite clearly that a people do have a right to secede if there is a government that does not conduct itself in compliance with the principle of equal rights and self-determination of peoples and representing the whole people belonging to the territory without distinction as to race, creed, or color. I think if you look at what happened in Ukraine, where you saw the United States government effectively orchestrate a neo-Nazi coup d'etat against the democratically elected and constitutionally legitimate government of Ukraine, one could see why the people of Crimea felt threatened. And we know that the United States government orchestrated that because of the telephone conversation between Assistant Secretary of State Nuland and U.S. Ambassador Pyatt, which was clearly a violation of the Budapest Agreement, the United Nations Charter, and again, the teachings of the World Court in the Nicaragua case. So,
can you explain a little more about that? I'm not sure that most people are aware of that allegation that the United States actually orchestrated the what you're calling the coup in Kiev in Ukraine.
Well, sure. You can just go on to YouTube if you want, or Google it, and you can hear the actual conversation between Assistant Secretary of State Nuland and U.S. Ambassador Pyatt plotting the overthrow of the democratically elected government of Ukraine under President Yanukovych.
I'd like to play just a segment of the leaked conversation between Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and U.S. Ambassador to the Ukraine.
Klitschko has been the top dog. He's going to take a while to show up for whatever meeting they've got, and he's probably talking to his guys at this point. So I think you reaching out directly to him helps with the personality management among the three, and it gives you also a chance to move fast on all this stuff and put us behind it before they all sit down and he explains why he doesn't like it.
Okay, good. I'm happy. Why don't you reach out to him and see if he wants to talk before or after?
Okay, will do. Thanks.
Okay, I've now written, one more wrinkle for you, Jeff.
Yeah.
I can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write
yeah.
you that this morning?
Yeah, okay. I saw that.
He's now gotten both Seri and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Seri could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, f*** the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it. And again, the fact that this is out there right now, I'm still trying to figure out in my mind why Yanukovych did that. But in the meantime, there's a Party of Regions faction meeting going on right now, and I'm sure there's a lively argument going on in that group at this point. But anyway, we could land Jelly Side up on this one if we move fast. So let me work on Klitschko, and if you can just keep, I think we want to try to get somebody with an international personality to come out here and help to midwife this thing. And then the other issue is some kind of outreach to Yanukovych, but we probably regroup on that tomorrow as we see how things start to fall into place.
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me VFR saying, you need Biden, and I said, probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So okay. Biden's willing.
Okay, great. All right. Thanks.
That was a segment from the leaked telephone conversation between Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Jeffrey Pyatt, which seems to imply that the U.S. had a hand in orchestrating the coup in Ukraine during the last week of February. We're speaking with Professor Francis Boyle about the issue, and I want to just get your take on that.
It's all there, and indeed, she admits we paid $5 billion over the years to get to this point. It was pretty much, I think, a classic coup d'etat in the history, long history of CIA coup d'etats against democratically elected governments, going back to the coup d'etat against the Mossadegh government in Iran in 1953, or the Arbenz government in 1954 in Guatemala. Bill Bloom, in his book Killing Hope, has a long list of governments, both democratic and non-democratic, that the United States government has overthrown over the years, starting with Iran in 1953. So the first act these neo-Nazis took was to eliminate Russian as an official language. They also abolished the Communist Party and the Party of the Regions, which was Yanukovych's party. They threw people out of office. There were threats made to communist Russians and Jews. So under these circumstances, I think people of Crimea did have a right to secede. This also gets to the Kosovo Declaration of Independence, when the shoe was on the other foot. And there the International Court of Justice held in its advisory opinion that there was nothing illegal with that Declaration of Independence. And as a matter of fact, there you even had a Security Council resolution adopted under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, guaranteeing the territorial integrity and political independence of Yugoslavia. And the World Court said, again, there was nothing illegal with the Declaration of Independence. So, you know, I think if you looked at what happened there, you had a right to secede, and they did validly exercise it. And there was really a question whether Russia wanted to accept them. I personally felt they shouldn't have, and I was on Voice of Russia several times saying that even though they might have a right to do so, it would make negotiations far more difficult to negotiate the way out of this very serious situation. But you know, Russia did annex them pursuant to their wishes. And you'll note my colleague there, Professor John Quigley at Ohio State Law School, independently of me, has also expressed an opinion that he thought that under these circumstances, the annexation would be valid. But right now we're in a very difficult situation. And as I've also said, of course, it's the height of hypocrisy for Biden and Kerry and Obama now all of a sudden to be invoking international law as if we're some great protector of international law, especially when Biden and Kerry knowingly voted for a clear-cut war of aggression against Iraq that took place in March of 2003. And Obama, you know, he's attacked Libya. He has drone strikes all over the world. I can't really say I've seen any evidence that he's demonstrated the least bit of respect for international law. And regretfully, he was after me at Harvard Law School. So unlike Bush, who was not a lawyer, Obama certainly knows better. So there we are as of today.
Well, and today the reports are coming out that a group of pro-Russians, including possibly troops, have taken over a Navy base, and the acting president of the Ukraine has demanded release of 70 hostages. Have you heard about this development? And I wonder if you have a comment on it.
Actually, right off the wire, services now has reported that Ukraine has decided to withdraw its position in Crimea completely. So let's hope that goes along peacefully. It just came out on the wire services now, and that there is not going to be any further loss of life under these circumstances.
Well, at the same time, it seems that President Obama is trying to organize an international response, calling for G7 or the G8, excluding Russia, to meet next week, and European Union leaders to discuss reaction and a possible military or other action in Crimea. Is that a possibility?
Well, as a matter of fact, even before Russia annexed Crimea, President Obama precipitously applied sanctions, and the European Union did too, in coordination with President Obama. All that has done is exacerbate the situation and made it more difficult to negotiate a way out of here. And if, in fact, Obama does go forward and adopt even more drastic economic sanctions, it will almost be impossible to negotiate a peaceful resolution of this dispute for the immediate future. Likewise, all this saber-rattling by Obama, I think, is highly provocative and uncalled for. Going on right now in Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Poland, Russia has made no threats at all towards those four states. So, again, all these threatened military maneuvers, I believe, are uncalled for and are extremely dangerous, and is not the way to proceed. The Russian government has made a formal offer, which I think is a reasonable proposal to negotiate, that Ukraine be neutralized, sort of along the lines of Switzerland, a neutral state, so that it would not join NATO, which, by the way, is what the promise that Bush Sr. gave to Gorbachev when he agreed to the reunification of NATO, that the NATO borders would not move to the east. Russia has also said there should be a constitutional system in Ukraine that is organized along the lines of a federal government that, like we have here in the United States, would give substantial powers to people on a local basis. And finally, that that Russian be restored as an official language. So it does seem to me that, you know, there are elements there that could lead to reasonable good faith negotiations. But so far, it does not look like the Obama administration is prepared to pursue them. Indeed, President Putin invited Secretary of State Kerry to come over to Russia to negotiate with him. And instead of doing that, Secretary of State Kerry sent him a list of questions, as if President Putin was on a witness stand being cross-examined by the state's attorney, which is, by the way, what Kerry used to be. You know, it's completely insulting. And when the Russians did not respond to this, then Kerry said, well, I'm not going to Russia to negotiate with President Putin. So I think, you know, it's this matter could still be negotiated on the basis of that Russian proposal.
Well, and President Obama, being a Democrat and having a reputation of being weak in the idea of some of the Republicans, do you think he's setting himself up by doing all of this saber rattling that he will have to continue along this line in order to avoid losing face?
Well, I think attitude in the United States by Obama and Kerry and Hagel and the rest of them is that we stole Kiev fair and square, and we're going to keep it, and it's that simple. And we're simply in the process now of consolidating our neo-Nazi pushes there in Kiev and trying to keep them in power and put them in power, and then insulting the Russians in the process, saying, you know, you have to deal with our neo-Nazi puppets there in Kiev. When some of these organizations go back cooperating with Hitler when Hitler invaded the Ukraine and, you know, killed maybe 6 million people and, you know, 26 million Soviets. So that, I think, I regret to say, seems to be our attitude so far.
Referencing back to World War II, Zbigniew Brzezinski has been on the national television comparing Putin's actions to those of Hitler. And I wonder if you can comment on that.
Brzezinski is an expatriate Pole who hates the Russians with a passion. He can't even be reasonable when it comes to the Russians. And his book, Grand Chessboard, he made it pretty clear he wants to break up Russia as a state into its constituent units. And my opinion, that what is behind here, the Obama policy, when Obama was a student at Columbia University, his mentor was Brzezinski. And when Obama ran for the presidency, Brzezinski was in charge of running his foreign policy team. And so when Obama came to power, Brzezinski made sure that all his acolytes occupied positions in the Obama administration that were acceptable to him. So I think we're seeing the working out of the Brzezinski policy here. And you even have Henry Kissinger objecting. I also went through the same PhD program that produced Kissinger ahead of me at Harvard. And Kissinger is a German Jew who fled the Nazis. So he does not have all this emotional baggage when it comes to Russia. And as we saw during the Nixon administration, Kissinger was able to pursue a reasonable, workmanlike, unemotional policy towards the Soviet Union and make some constructive gains with Nixon, like détente and SALT I and the ABM Treaty, and then almost finishing up SALT II. So even Kissinger has publicly criticized this policy. He had an essay in the Washington Post saying it's no policy at all. I think it's because Kissinger realizes it's Brzezinski and his acolytes who are running this policy, and how dangerous this is if we continue moving down this path, which we're going down now.
Zbigniew Brzezinski has been an advisor to a number of presidential administrations, and what you're saying is that he is acting as an advisor to President Obama on this as well?
Well, he's President Obama's guru on all foreign affairs issues, right? Again, they go back to when Obama was his student at Columbia, and then he ran the Obama Foreign Affairs campaign and then made sure the Obama administration was stacked with his people. So he's got his people all up and down this administration, and they're listening to Brzezinski. As you are correct that Brzezinski was the chair of the Trilateral Commission under David Rockefeller, and they recruited and co-opted the Georgia governor, Jimmy Carter, to run for president. And Brzezinski ran his foreign affairs operation, his campaign for Carter, and then when Carter was elected, he became Brzezinski became Carter's national security advisor, and we saw that Brzezinski publicly bragged about instituting the jihad campaign against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, and said, yes, this was long planned even before the Soviets invaded. In fact, we enticed them to invade. So now that he's accomplished that objective, Brzezinski is moving on to the collapse of the Russian Federation. So that's why we're seeing so little dissent here to what is going on, except Kissinger's very strong statement, I think, is quite significant, and people need to pay attention to that. Kissinger is saying this isn't a policy, and he was specifically referring to this demonization of Putin by Kissinger, by Brzezinski and his poodle, Madeleine Albright. She got her start working for Brzezinski. So there they were, both on CNN, comparing Putin to Hitler. Well, you know, this just an outright insult. This has nothing at all to do with that, and you're just demonizing and insulting an entire race of people over there who suffered terribly under the Germans and the Nazis. So this is just, in my opinion, it's just madness by Brzezinski. He simply cannot be rational or reasonable when it comes to the Russians because of his background.
Well, and I think a lot of people are concerned about this rhetoric around Crimea and are interested in ensuring that there is not more bloodshed. And I wonder if you can describe what you think is the best way or the best approach.
What happened. I think we have to move forward from here and try to figure out a way for a peaceful, negotiated solution. I think the last Russian proposal last week by Foreign Minister Lavrov, that undoubtedly had the approval of President Putin, is a good basis to do this. And I think we should be working from that rather than increasing economic sanctions and then saber rattling that's completely uncalled for. So I think we have to work with that. And unfortunately, it doesn't look like that's what we're doing.
Well, I do want to thank you for joining us today. I've been speaking with Francis Boyle. He is a professor at the University of Illinois College of Law, author of Foundations of World Order, among other books. And we've been speaking about the situation in Crimea and Ukraine. Thank you for joining us today, Francis Boyle.
Well, thank you for having me on and for a good interview. You asked some tough questions, and that's always a good sign.
Well, thanks so much. This is Jinka sure. Soderberg with KBOO News.
Hi, I'm your host for The Union of Time Thieves, a new radio exploration of urban life. This episode, we will take a look at monuments, what they are, how they affect us, and how we can reclaim them. The Union of Time Thieves will be on the fourth Monday of each month from 10 p.m. to 11 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
KBOO would like you to grin and bear it. It's a bear variety show. Bears on film, bears in songs, dub bears, queer bears, dancing bears, bear improv, bear comedy, bear fitness tips. I can barely stand it. And here are the bear facts. It's Friday, March 21st from 7 to 9:30 at the IPRC, 1001 Southeast Division Street. That's Friday, March 21st from 7 to 9:30. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community
Every
Events.
Every teddy bear who's been good is sure of a treat today. There's lots of marvelous things to eat and wonderful games to play.
This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM, Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM, Philomath and Corvallis, K220HR Hood River, K282BH Philomath.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Occupy Radio. Today we go to the Occupy Media Collective and their podcast, which you can find at podomatic.com/profile/DSGetch. That's GETCH 65488. You'll be able to find a link to that on the Occupy Portland KBOO webpage. We have some music from friend of the show, Lullaby. So stay tuned for this podcast of Occupy the Media and their guest, William K. Black, who we've featured on Occupy Radio previously. This podcast, which is available at Podomatic, is titled Air Occupy, William Black on Why Haven't We Had a Perp Walk? I'm Jimmy Tardy. This is Occupy Radio.
T-minus four and counting.
Welcome to Air Occupy, the radio show that speaks truth to power and occupies your mind for the next hour. I'm Liz, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Jerry and Shannon.
Morning.
Hey.
As you remember, on past shows, we've talked about financial regulation, but today we want to look at recent financial crimes. We've heard about many, many bank scandals. The banks have been busy getting caught, not to mention the past crimes that we haven't seen any criminal prosecutions for, such as, and I'm quoting from an article from Charles Ferguson of The Guardian, because he did such a good job of this concise summary, selling defective mortgage securities during the housing bubble, creating and selling securities to bet on their failure, bringing the world to the brink of collapse, colluding to manipulate interest rates, hyping your failing company while secretly selling your own stock, cooking the books and assisting Bernie Madoff. But the scandals go on. Those are the scandals of the past. The scandals have continued. We have the LIBOR scandal, J.P. Morgan Chase's $9 billion London whale, money laundering for terrorists, tax cheats and drug traffickers, Wells Fargo discriminated against minorities and pushed them into subprime loans. Credit cards are now paying fines because of the add-on services that they pushed, and hedge funds are looting customer segregated accounts.
You know, we had taken a look in a previous show at the Dodd-Frank legislation and the proposed Volcker rule. There under, we talked to people from Occupy SEC, and what we thought we needed to do today was to back up a little bit and come out of the weeds a bit and talk more generally about regulation of the financial services sector. As Liz noted, this litany of endemic fraud and seeming culture of impunity on the part of our financial services sector, CEOs, boards, officers, a willingness to commit fraud in this sort of endemic way. What do we need to be thinking about in terms of the way we regulate the financial services sector?
We'll be talking with Bill Black, Professor Bill Black, in the second part of our show. He's a noted white-collar criminologist, a former federal regulator, author of the 2005 book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, and associate professor of law and economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. So do you want to start with LIBOR and kind of talk about...
Yeah, the LIBOR is the...